Lecture 4, Confessions, Love and Tears.
Augustine, Philosopher and Saint, Lecture number 4. In this lecture, we're looking again at Augustine's life as told in the Confessions, and we're looking at it now from the emotional angle, after having looked at it from the intellectual angle last time. But once again, we can start with philosophy, which sounds, of course, very intellectual, but philosophy for Augustine means the love of wisdom. And he never tires of reminding us that the word philosophy is a Greek word meaning love of wisdom. So philosophy is a form of love. And therefore, philosophy is a way of entering into this emotional angle on Augustine's Confessions, where we look at Augustine's heart, its loves and losses. Philosophy is a form of love. It's a way of seeking something, seeking wisdom. And the philosophers in the ancient world had a theory about how the heart sought things and why. And it all centered on happiness. Think about happiness for a minute. Happiness is a final goal of our seeking. We don't seek happiness for the sake of something else. We seek other things for the sake of happiness. If we're wise, we seek money for the sake of other things and not for its own sake. We seek power, if we're wise, for the sake of doing something good that will make us and others happy. But you don't seek happiness for the sake of something else. Once you have attained something that makes you happy, that's where you want to be. That's what you were going for. It's not a step on the road, it's the goal. So happiness is the final goal of our lives. The problem is, of course, that most happiness in this world is temporary. It fades away. Sometimes it's just a mere passing pleasure. Sometimes it's something that lasts for a while, a few days, a few months, then fades away. Augustine wants an ultimate, final happiness, a happiness that won't fade away, an eternal happiness. That's what he seeks. That's what he loves. And, of course, the eternal happiness he hopes to find, or rather the thing he hopes to find that will make him eternally happy, is God. So that's the emotional angle. It's the angle of love, of seeking that which will make us ultimately happy. Now, the problem is, of course, that most of our loves are directed at things that won't make us ultimately happy. And we can talk about this in terms of what is really the highest and best of all earthly loves, and that's the love of friendship. Augustine loves friendship. Friendship is literally the best thing on earth. It is a form of love. But it can go wrong because it's not the highest thing of all. And friendship, after all, can be the source of terrible, terrible grief. And Augustine describes a friendship in book four, of the Confessions. And he describes the grief that results when he loses his friend in death. And it's one of the most moving passages in all of ancient literature, indeed all of Western literature. Let me sketch the story here, and then we'll talk about the analysis of grief that Augustine gives us in Book 4 of the Confessions. Augustine, in Book 4 of the Confessions, is a Manichaean. He's a heretic, the bright young man in Africa, smarter than all the other people, and he's leading a whole bunch of his friends into heresy with him. A bunch of adolescents in sort of fundamentalist, Bible Belt, rock-ribbed Catholic Africa, who think that they're smarter than all those dumb Catholics. They're Manichaeans, they're more spiritual, and he's leading a lot of them astray. That's what Augustine the bishop, the author of the Confessions, thinks. Of course, young Augustine at the time thinks that he's leading them into a more sophisticated form of religion, a more spiritual religion, a smarter religion. And he's mesmerizing all these friends of his. And one of them is a young man that he's very close to. And this young man falls mortally ill. They are afraid for his life. He falls unconscious. And what happens is, while he's unconscious, they baptize him. And Augustine, the Manichaean, thinks that this is a joke. And the young man recovers. He recovers consciousness, and briefly he recovers health. And everybody takes a deep sigh of relief and thinks, oh, he's out of the woods, he's out of danger, he's not going to die. And Augustine goes to his bedside and says, ah, well, you've recovered. And you know what they did to you while you were unconscious? guess what? They splashed you with a little water and said a few words and said you were baptized and now you're a Catholic. Ha! Isn't that a good joke? And his friend looked at him and said, well, his friend looked at him as if I were an enemy, says Augustine, and rebuked him. And lo and behold, his friend had turned into a Catholic. He woke up, well, he went to bed a Manichaean, or rather went into unconsciousness as a Manichaean, got baptized, regained consciousness, and he was a Catholic. And Augustine couldn't make sense out of this. And he figured, well, all right, this guy is superstitious or something. I'll get back to him and I'll turn him back into something intelligent like a Manichaean again. But before he has a chance to do that, his friend gets ill again, relapses, and dies. Augustine the bishop, right in the Confessions, says, what happened is that God, in his mercy, snatched his friend away from him, away from his folly, so that he could keep him safe forever. God was taking this friend away from him out of mercy, keeping him safe for all eternity, so that he wouldn't turn back into a Manichaean. Because, of course, if you die a Manichaean, you die damned. This is something that Augustine takes for granted and the whole Catholic Church took for granted at the time. If you die outside of the Church as a heretic, you die as a damned person. So Augustine's friend dies as a Catholic, freshly baptized, his sins freshly forgiven. Augustine's friend is safe from all harm. But young Augustine the Manichaean can't see it that way. He cannot possibly imagine anything good coming out of this. And he describes, or rather now Augustine the bishop, describes the grief of young Augustine in terms that are so extraordinarily memorable that I've just got to read it to you. It's one of the most, well, as I say, I think it's the most moving description of grief that I know of. And it shows you Augustine the poet, as it were. At this sorrow, my heart was utterly darkened, and whatever I looked upon was death. My native land was sheer torture to me, and my father's house was a terrible emptiness, a terrible unhappiness. And whatever I had done with this friend of mine, now that he was gone, turned into terrible torture. My eyes looked for him everywhere. I sought him everywhere with my eyes, but he was not granted to me. And I hated all places because he was not in them. Nor could those places say to me, look, he's coming, as they did when he was alive. It's as if the whole world is empty of his friend. Every place he turns, there's just sheer absence. I keep on being bowled over by that passage, by the poetical power of it. But behind it, interestingly enough, is a theory. Augustine never has poetry without a philosophical theory behind it. And the theory itself is very beautiful. It's a theory about the nature of friendship, and then, therefore, the nature of grief. Friendship is a form of love. Every ancient philosopher agreed about that. It's a form of love which unites two souls. And Augustine's convinced that what love always does is unites you, or seeks to unite you with something. When you love something, you're trying to be united to it. And when you enjoy a love, that means you are being united to the thing you seek. So in friendship, you are united with your friend. Not united the way that sex unites one body with another, but united soul to soul. Right? Friendship makes two souls into one. It makes many souls into one if you've got a whole circle of friends. And what grief is the agony that comes upon your soul when it's torn in two, when half of your soul gets ripped away from you and you can't find it anymore. And you look all around the world, in every place in the world, and all you sense is the absence of that other half of your soul. You used to be one soul. Now you're only half a soul. That's why grief feels so awful. The theory underlies the poetry. And Augustine gets them to work together just beautifully. At least that's how it seems to me. I'm very impressed by the combination of philosophy and poetry in this passage. Now, what do you do about grief? It's not like you're not supposed to love your friend, after all. Friendship is good. It's one of the best things in the world. In fact, it's the best thing on earth. So, what do you do? The problem, you see, that Augustine had is that he loved his friend as if his friend would never die. He was cleaving to his friend as if this friendship could make him ultimately happy. He says, I love this man as if he would never die, as if he was immortal. And guess what? He wasn't immortal. And guess what the punishment of loving what's mortal is? You're loving something that's going to die. You're loving something that you will inevitably lose. And that's what was wrong. Not that he loved his friend, but that he sought ultimate happiness in friendship, as if friendship was a love that would never die. Now, there is good news, though, and Augustine dwells on this toward the end of his discussion of grief in Book 4, and that is that it's possible to love our friends in God, Augustine says. Remember, his friend was kept safe by God for eternity, right? So Augustine the bishop can be comforted that his friend is safe for eternity, and he can love his friend in God, is how he puts it. When you love something in God, you love something for the sake of the happiness which is eternal, and you share in a happiness that is eternal with your friend. And so loving your friend in God means that you will love what is never lost, love what cannot be lost, because ultimately, fundamentally, most deeply, you're loving God, who can never be lost, and in God you love your friend, who is being kept safe for eternity by God. And that protects you from that aching, awful grief. The grief is supposed to be, for Augustine, a sign that something's going wrong. Life shouldn't be that miserable. If you are that miserable, that grief-stricken, that's a sign that your love has gone astray. You've tried to find eternal happiness by loving something that's not eternal. And that's not going to make you happy. It's going to make you miserable. And the more beautiful and good and wonderful the love, the more agonizing is the loss, right? The loss of a friend is much more agonizing than the loss of money, because a friend is so much better than money. When you lose a friend, your grief is as great as grief can be on earth. Let me make a footnote now. It turns out that Augustine uses the language of friendship to talk about the woman he lived with for many years. And this is an important point. Augustine has a reputation as having a wild and promiscuous youth. And that reputation, I think, is much exaggerated. He evidently went through some kind of period of adolescent experimentation. We don't know really how extensive it was. But very quickly, he settled down with one woman for about 15 years. It's very much like what we would call a common law marriage. He calls her a concubine. That's the official status that she had under the law in the Roman Empire. He was faithful to her. He lived with her and slept with her for 15 years. He actually had a son with her. And he loved her. And he describes losing her the way he describes losing his friend. For reasons that we'll get to in the next lecture, he had to send her away. Basically, he divorces her. And he sends her away. And here's how he describes what happens. My mistress was torn from my side, and my heart, which cleaved to her, was racked and wounded and bleeding. There's that image of you know, the soul that becomes one soul, two souls united, and then torn apart, and your heart or soul becomes a bleeding half thing. He's talking about the woman he loves as a friend, which is really, for him, the highest form of love, is friendship. So Augustine's sex life is not just wild promiscuity. Indeed, I think Augustine, despite his reputation, is not really obsessed with sex, as people will sometimes say. If he had a choice, he would write books about friendship and not about sex. Unfortunately, he didn't have a choice, and he had to write a lot of books about sex. And he said things about sex that most people don't like. But what he says about friendship is, well, more beautiful, still disturbing, because of the stuff about grief and the stuff about loving your friend too much or the wrong way. It's kind of surprising to discover you can love your friend the wrong way. And Augustine's very convinced that that's true. Well, the language of love and the experience of love and grief gets even more complicated when we look at the second most important character, or should we say the third most important character, in the Confessions. If God is the most important character, and Augustine's the second most important character, then the third one after that is Monica, Augustine's mother. Monica's an amazing character. She is probably the strongest, most positive character in Western ancient literature. The only characters, only female characters I can think of who are as formidable as her are evil characters like Medea. Augustine portrays Monica as this very powerful woman, emotionally powerful, right? She didn't have social power, but she was a very powerful force in his life. For instance, when he was in danger of experimenting with adolescent lust, Augustine's mother, Monica, warned him about this, and her warning was, for Augustine, like the voice of God. Augustine the bishop says that it was God speaking to me through her voice. Of course, if you're an adolescent and you're hearing your mother speaking in the voice of God, there's a certain amount of resentment that goes with that, and you can see that or feel that undercurrent of resentment in Augustine's confessions. She is, well, you feel about her the way you feel about a very formidable, powerful woman who is your mother, and you're a bright boy and you want to kind of escape from her. But she's also the one who's, more than anyone else, was responsible for saving his soul. And we'll talk about that in just a second. She is the Catholic mother. The good Catholic mother, right? She and Africa belong together. Africa is the Bible Belt, the rock-ribbed, staunch fundamentalist place where fundamentalist Catholics live and raise their children. And Monica is the rock-ribbed, staunch Catholic fundamentalist. And she's Catholic to the core. When Augustine talks about the name of Christ, remember he says he drank it in with his mother's milk, and he was thinking of Monica. An example of what I mean by this Catholic mother is a dream she has. She dreamed when he was a heretic, back when he was a Manichaean. She had a dream that comforted her because she dreamed that she was standing on a wooden ruler, and the ruler was a symbol for the rule of faith, which is the creed and the Catholic confession. And an angel came to her and said, "Fear not, don't be disturbed. Your son is going to be where you are. Where you are, there he shall be." She tells this dream later on to Augustine, saying, "I'm confident that you will become Catholic again because the angel told me, you know, where you are, there he shall be." Now, Augustine tries to reinterpret the dream and says, "Well, Mom, what he means is that you too can have the hope of becoming a Manichaean like me and leave the Catholic Church and be smart like me." And Monica says, "No, no, no. The angel said, where you are, he shall be. And he said to me, where you, Monica, are, he shall be." So here's this brilliant son of hers trying to fight with her over the interpretation of the dream. And unlike his experience with the Catholic priests where he could argue circles around them, he couldn't change Monica's mind. He couldn't beat her in the argument. She knew what her dream meant, and she wasn't going to change her mind. Her dream was a Catholic dream. On the other hand, Monica is hardly a perfect Catholic. Nobody is. Augustine describes her as being still lurking on the outskirts of Babylon. Babylon is the symbol of the earthly secular city, the city of sin and ambition and pride and all those sinful things. You're supposed to flee out of Babylon. But Monica still lingered around on the outskirts. What that meant is she still had worldly ambitions. She had worldly ambitions for her brilliant boy. She knew that this was a lad of great promise, and she wanted him to go places in the world. So as a result, she did a number of things which Augustine did not approve of. That is, Augustine the bishop did not approve of what his mother did. For one thing, she said that Augustine needed to delay getting married. The adolescent experimenting was going on, but... Well, think of it like this. Imagine a good Catholic mother nowadays who has a very bright, promising son. Does she want that son to get married straight out of high school? No way. No way. You send them off to some good Catholic school like Villanova or Notre Dame, and you make sure they don't get married. Well, that was Monica, right? And Augustine the bishop complains, "This way, the best remedy against adolescent lust was taken away from me. I could have gotten married and used my lust the right way, but no, I had to fall into all those sins because no one was ready for me to get married." Likewise, they delayed baptizing him. He was about to get baptized once when he was very sick, but they decided not to when he recovered, because once again, they figured, let him get some of his sinning out of his system when he's an adolescent, and then we can baptize him and sort of give him a clean slate, and he'll be all right. But you don't want to baptize him before his adolescence, because then he'll go on and sin some more, and he'll have to go through all the repentance that you have to go through. Let's delay baptism. A typical thing, by the way, in those days. Augustine the bishop, didn't approve of that. And finally, when he was in his 30s, having delayed his marriage, Monica helps arrange a marriage for him. She arranges a marriage for him that is advantageous with a rich Christian girl who's underage, and that's why he has to send away his concubine, because he's engaged to be married to a rich Christian heiress who will further his career by giving him a lot of money in her dowry. You see, so when you're 30 and your career is launched, then you can get married. And then you don't get married for love, you get married for money. Literally, that's what he was marrying for. And the marriage was arranged more or less by Monica. So that's all kind of, impure, right? She's not a perfect Catholic. She's still on the outskirts of Babylon. She still has mixed motives. But even with those mixed motives, Monica is the single most powerful force for good in Augustine's life, according to Augustine the bishop. The theme here comes out most powerfully in a wonderful scene where Monica talks to a Catholic priest that has just been talking to her heretic son, and the heretic son is not going to listen to the priest, and the priest isn't even going to bother talking to him, because the priest says, look, this boy is too proud, and he's not going to listen, so you're just going to have to wait until he's ready to listen and be instructed. And Monica's disconsolate, she weeps over this, but the priest tells her, and really he promises her, the son of these tears cannot perish, right? Pointing to Monica's tears. Those tears are going to guarantee that this son of yours is not going to perish. Now, of course, Augustine the bishop doesn't literally believe that tears can save someone, but tears come not just from the eyes, but from the heart. And what is in Monica's heart is a continual prayer for the salvation of her son's soul. And God's not going to ignore that prayer. And that's what that means. The son of these tears, the son of these prayers, the son of this love that Monica has for Augustine, desiring to see his soul saved, that son of that tear and that of tears and love and longing, that son cannot perish. So, on the other hand, once again, these tears are not pure. There's a wonderful episode, or terrible episode, depending how you think of it, where Augustine ditches his mother. Remember, he has to leave Africa to go where the action is, in Italy, right? He's got to get out of this provincial burg and go to the Big Apple. So he's leaving Africa, and he's going to leave his mother, too. And what he does is he says, Mom, the ship has been delayed. I've got to go across the ocean to Italy, but the ship's been delayed. Why don't you go up and pray for a while, and I'll tell you when we're ready to go. So she goes up and prays. He gets on the ship, and he goes and leaves her behind. And he goes to Italy to seek his fortune, leaving Monica behind, weeping, the tears in her eyes again, praying. But Augustine has a kind of analysis of these tears again, because her tears are impure. She's weeping for two reasons. One is she's weeping, like always, because her son's a heretic, and she doesn't want her son to be damned. But the other reason she's weeping is just because her son has left her behind. She doesn't like to let her beautiful boy out of her sight, right? There's a little bit of what they call smother love in Monica, right? This is an impure love. This is the wrong kind of love. The love which is simply attached to the physical presence of another person, as if this other person can make you happy, ultimately, is a mistake. And Monica has to suffer grief from it, the same kind of grief that you have when you lose a friend. She has to suffer grief, and she has to learn. And the grief is a kind of, punishment, which has the purpose of purifying her heart so that those tears can be tears that are really devoted to Augustine's soul and not just to his physical presence, right? So that she may learn to love him spiritually, not love him with this smother love. But meanwhile, even these impure tears, Augustine says, are a sign of God's love for him. Indeed, for the only time I can think of in the Confessions, Augustine uses the word predestination in connection with those tears. That is, Augustine was predestined to be saved, he believes. And the reason he knows that is because God cannot let the son of these tears perish. Right? There's some deep connection between Monica's prayers and the fact that Augustine is predestined to be saved. The son of these tears cannot, eternally cannot perish. So, Monica does eventually follow her son to Italy. She is introduced to Ambrose. She loves Ambrose. She's convinced that Ambrose is going to help convert her son back to Catholicism, and she's right. She's actually nearby when Augustine finally is converted and returns to the Catholic Church. And then afterwards, a few months later, in the port town of Ostia, near Rome, where they're waiting to get set sail back to Italy, they're in Ostia, in Italy, ready to set sail back to North Africa. And they're delayed for a moment, and Augustine and his mother are talking at the window outside, looking outside at a garden. And together, they have a vision of eternal wisdom. Monica and Augustine together. It's astonishing. The only account I know of a joint, dual, mystical vision. Augustine symbolizing, I think, reason and understanding. Monica symbolizing faith and authority. Both seeing the same thing. Right? The rock-ribbed, non-philosophical Catholic believer and the Catholic philosopher together are seeking the same wisdom and seeing the same wisdom. That's what Ostia means, that philosophy and faith go together. Likewise, last episode about Monica. When she dies, more tears. But this time it's Augustine's tears for Monica. Again, the tears are impure. He tries to restrain his tears because he knows, after all, she's not gone, right? He's missing her physical presence, but he's not missing her. She's with God. She dies far from home, and she had always been concerned that she wanted to be buried with her husband in Africa, but she dies in Italy, far from home. But she's no longer concerned. She's seen her beautiful son be converted. He's safe eternally, and now she doesn't care where she dies. She says, oh, bury my body anywhere. God knows where to find it on the last day. She's no longer concerned about the location of her body, but her son is. Her son misses her. Misses her physical presence, and he weeps over her because he doesn't really know in his heart that she's safe. He doesn't believe in his heart that she's safe, that she's with God. He doesn't yet love her in God as he should. That's something he still has to learn. So he kind of blames himself for weeping over his mother's death. People have a hard time with that. They don't like the fact that he actually seems to be mad at himself for weeping over his mother's death. But I think what's ultimately behind it is this critique that Augustine has of the impurity of our loves. We should love one another in God. We shouldn't love one another as if some other human being could make us ultimately happy. We shouldn't grieve over them as if losing them was losing the most important thing in life. Because, after all, he hasn't lost her. He's kept her safe for eternity in God. God has kept her safe. So, you see, in the Confessions, you've got this story of love and loss. And love unites us with things. And if it unites us with something that we're going to lose, it's going to unite us with grief and sorrow and misery. That's the punishment of sin, by the way. Sin is punished because sin is loving what you inevitably lose. Sin is loving what will inevitably cause you grief. Sin means being far from what will cause you eternal happiness. Sin means turning away from the eternal happiness and glomming onto something that's only going to make you miserable when you lose it. Sin means being far from your eternal home. It means losing what you love. And one of the wonderful things about the Confessions is that Augustine's talking about sin all the time, and he very seldom seems to be talking as if he feels guilty. When he talks about sin, the emotional tone that he adopts is a tone of grief. Sin makes him feel not guilty, but grief-stricken, miserable, longing, almost nostalgic. That's the ultimate punishment of sin, is to lose what you love. Now, the opposite side of it is, the best state to be in is a state of longing and prayer, sighing for that country that you're far away from, but you want to get back to. And next time, we need to talk about what it's like being on the road back to home.